Last week, a group of professionals of color held an event for the purpose of discussing authentic self in the workplace. Murray Woodard is a program officer at the Kauffman Foundation. Woodard, who is Black and was one of the authentic self panelists, mentioned that while people in communities of color often talk about mentorship as part of being able to better succeed in predominantly white workplaces, it's about taking mentorship a step further to sponsorship.
Are you willing to put your personal reputation on the line to ensure that someone else gets a leg up? And that to me is what sponsorship is.
Laura Isabel Alvarez, another panelist who is Hispanic, is a manager at H&R Block. Alvarez wasn't surprised that this was a sold-out event filled with more than 80 professional people of color who understand the balancing act of fitting in while being yourself.
People just need to hear, hey, you're not crazy. It's a thing. And it's okay to be your authentic self, but also understand what position you're in and where you're at.
I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson in for Gina Kauffman, and on today's Central Standard, we're diving into a conversation about authenticity and diversity in the workplace. According to a report by the Urban Institute back in 2013, Kansas City ranked 222 on racial inclusion compared to 274 other cities that were evaluated. But what does that look like today? Because a lot has happened since 2013. And for Kansas City professionals of color, how does that translate to the day-to-day realities of going to work? With me today is Nicole Jacobs-Sylvie, president and founder of Connection Coach KC. Hey, Nicole.
Hey, Michelle.
And Edgar Palacios. He's the founder of the Latinx Education Collaborative. Hey, Edgar.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias. Okay, I do remember enough to respond back to that properly. Now, past that, I'm gone. Okay. So, welcome to the show, everyone who's listening. So, when people typically talk about diversity and inclusion efforts, it's typically talked about from the employer standpoint. Are organizations having the right numbers? What are their recruiting efforts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But let's talk about it from the perspective of an employee. Nicole, as a Black woman, over the years, what are some of the cues you look for when you're considering whether an employer is going to be a potential good fit for you?
I often start, as so many people do, by looking at the website for an organization or for a company and looking to see the faces, honestly, that are shown, and not only who is hired, but what level of leadership positions they have. I also tap into my network to vet organizations to see what that corporate culture or that organization's culture is like. Is it welcoming to people of color in terms of recruitment opportunities, but also advancement opportunities, opportunities to have influence on the overall strategic plan? Those are the things that I look for, as well as mentorship. Those are key components that I think are crucial for any job employment.
Great. So, Edgar, same question as a Latino male. What do you look for? What are the cues that help you to sort of figure out, is this going to be a place where I can not just do a great job, but do it as me?
You know, I think it's incredibly difficult for people of color, especially going into their first jobs or second or third jobs, to really understand how to navigate the culture, because sometimes it's presented as one way. And until you're really in there, you don't know what is going on. So I immediately like to build relationships with other people of color to kind of ask them those questions behind the scenes and say, hey, what really happens here? How are they going to perceive me? What are the things that they say? And then if I get brave enough, I'll talk to a couple of leaders and ask them directly, how do you feel about this? Well, you know, what are your thoughts on this? And because a lot of corporations do have diversity inclusion plans in place. Now, do they follow and do they actively put resources towards those plans? That's a completely different question.
That's totally it. I mean, I think that's something that everybody always looks at. I mean, folks, again, the focus always tends to be on the employer, but as we were talking about before the show, a company's best recruiting tool is retention. It's the people who already work there who can organically say how great it is or what it's really like and answer those questions when asked. So, okay, down the path of working someplace, what, Nicole, I'll start with you again, what do you do to figure out once you get there how you can, again, walk that walk of doing your job, being great at your job, but still fitting into that culture?
You know, I often, echoing what Edgar said about diversity statements, I look at intention and then execution. And so you easily, navigating that environment and finding those allies is crucial, because there are people who can be your champion or your sponsor. And I think as a person of color, there are barriers, some very visible and some more subdued or subconscious, that you have to navigate, and finding those people that can help you hurdle around them, crawl under them, however you get past those boundaries. And I think that's so crucial. Being able to get any type of influence possible. So being at the table, where especially HR at most organizations, that's where change really happens, from the intention to the execution. It takes really just getting in an environment and navigating and scoping out where opportunities may be.
Edgar, don't you think, what do you think about that?
Again, it's incredibly difficult. I will say this, you have to be willing to be part of the solution. And if you have ideas that you can bring to the table, and you have the right sponsors, Murray mentioned that in the intro, it's about sponsorship. And so there may be people at the higher ranks of an organization that are willing to support your initiatives if you're willing to have those conversations and be honest from the very beginning. You can't really give up on a corporation or a nonprofit organization if you haven't really tried yourself to make it as inclusive as possible.
You know, I've over the years, I'm sure you guys have heard this too, so many people who are white assume that when there's a posting for a job and they make a big point of saying diversity included, we're a diverse and inclusive place, they read that to mean, oh great, that means the people of color are going to have the first shot at a job before white people. What, I'll start with you on this, Edgar. What's the reality of that?
You know, time and time and again, I walk into rooms and I'm the only Latino in the room. So, you know, anecdotally, I don't have the data in front of me, but anecdotally, you know, if hiring practices were such that they were preferring to hire people of color over others, then my experience would be very rare, but it's not. I walk into rooms. I think Nicole, both and I have walked into many different rooms and different environments, and we find ourselves to be the only people of color in the room. I say when we're there, it is our job to bring people to the table and to kind of reach back and bring those that have not had that opportunity, and use whatever privilege we have to make sure that those that don't have that kind of privilege are able to participate at those tables.
Exactly. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. Edgar said it so well, and we are often one of the only. And I find that intention to execution still continues to be the issue, because I will talk to, I think, well-meaning, very sincere individuals who want to diversify their environment, their workforce, but then they say, I don't know where to find quality people of color. And they always, there's that qualifier of quality people of color. And I know a plethora of individuals. And when asked further, what environments have you checked? We do, as human nature, we say, who do we know?
Right, exactly.
And then no names come forward. And it goes to the deeper question that we are still largely in segregated communities, that the people that we are interacting with on a day-to-day basis are people who look like us. So majority culture around majority culture individuals, and or it's the same five names that we often hear, be it in the Latinx or the African-American communities.
Yes.
I think there are two barriers there, to your point, Nicole. One is, can you find a pool of diverse talent? And then there's always that second qualifier after that. If you can bring a person 500 names of people who are qualified for the job, then it becomes about culture fit. And that's a much more subjective way of weeding out certain types of people. And, you know, that's really something that if you don't address unconscious bias in your hiring practices or in the workplace in general, you're going to be very subject to those experiences, and you're never going to find that right person of color to join your organization.
It's so true, because I used to be an employment attorney, and I used to work for firms that represented the companies, and that word fit over and over again, both when it's a good fit and when it's a bad fit, come up over and over again, because it's such a subjective way of analyzing the experience. So one of the things I remember Laura talked about at the Authentic Self panel I went to last week, which was really great, was she told a story about as a lighter skinned Latina who owned that she had that skin privilege, and that she did an experiment where she dyed her hair blonde and cut it into a bob to see if people would react differently to her at work in terms of assignments, in terms of interaction. And then she went back to her, you know, lustrous dark brown locks that grew out the bob, and she could then go and look to see how people were looking at her differently there. What are ways that people of color tailor themselves to fit into the workplace? They don't go as far as, you know, dyeing their hair, but what are the ways that people do that?
I'd like to address something in that statement as well, because there are a lot of issues in terms of diversity when it comes to that. Are you male? Are you female? Colorism is a huge issue. So I'm Latino, but I'm very light. And so I have some passing privileges in some rooms that other folks who are Latino as well may not. There's socioeconomic status. So there are a bunch of different types of diversity that you're bringing to the table. And based on where you are on each of those spectrums, you're going to have to, sometimes you have to cover in a way that it may feel inauthentic to you, may not go against, may go against what you truly believe in, because you have no other options in those rooms, or nobody has taught you how to navigate those systems. So we could talk about racial diversity at all, but I mean, the difference between men and women, and the difference between light skin versus dark skin, there's an incredible vast array of how people will treat you based on all those different types of being.
So true. And Nicole, what is a person of color? How does that play into how you even do your job when you have to do all that navigating?
It's nuanced at best. And when we were talking about this at the panel, it was very telling. Having been socialized that to succumb to the norms of majority culture was the way to succeed, that we would see the examples of those leaders who had made it, and they had to have a look a certain way that they spoke. And this is beyond, of course, basic professionalism. I mean, it related to socioeconomic status. There's so many factors to that. And some of it was spoken. Mentors would say that, or families would tell you how to dress, or you can't wear your hair a certain way. And then there's those unspoken rules that you would see. So I'm very much aware that I have, over the years, molded and melded and shape myself to fit that for career opportunities. And we talked about at the panel that people of color, on a day-to-day basis, moment by moment, are making a sense of risk analysis to determine how much of their true cultural selves they can bring to the workplace, and whether what are the consequences of that. That is something, that's the realities, and colorism is so real and plays out in so many ways. And to acknowledge that you have privilege based on maybe skin hue is very difficult, and an honest conversation that people of color have been having amongst each other.
Exactly. You know, somebody just tweeted that jobs are just as segregated as the housing, as the shopping, as the entertainment options in Kansas City. Do you guys find that to be the case? I know. All right.
Absolutely.
That was putting you on the spot.
You know, yeah. You know, depending on where you work, I think some companies, some organizations are really committed to diversity and inclusion, and they really make great attempts, and they are effective at showing that. And then there are other companies in the metro that are not like that. I'm not going to call any names, but I mean, we all know who they are. Well, I should say people of color know who they are. Because we've been in those environments, we talked amongst each other, and we bring those relationships. We try to, I think, help each other out as best as we can to say, hey, these are environments that you don't want to be in today. These are environments that are going to be amenable to you. I also want to say that this starts at a very young age. I remember being in fifth or sixth grade talking to my guidance counselor, saying, having a conversation where my guidance counselor was saying, wow, your English is really beautiful. You're very articulate. Mm-hmm. My parents are immigrants. You know, they came from Nicaragua in 1981. And so they were with me, of course. And so their English was broken and not the best. But they were just surprised to see me as, oh. Yeah. And so you start learning from a very young age how to – some of us are lucky in that we have agency and we know how to defend ourselves from an early age. And some of us don't learn that until very later in life. So this is not something that we just experienced today. This is something that we've been working through since you know, we knew that it existed.
Yeah, it's contextual. It's not just that particular job. It's the context of your life.
Right.
So we're continuing our conversation on workplace diversity after this short break. We want to hear from you. So call us at 816-235-288. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Stay tuned. We are back, and I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I am in for Gina Kaufman today. So have the places you've worked at Kansas City been inclusive or diverse? Or more importantly, how do you as an employee figure out how to navigate a place that maybe it isn't as inclusive or diverse as you'd like it to be? We'd really love to hear from you. Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. So, you know, one of the things about being your authentic self at work is what you can and what you can't talk about and without thinking. I had the great luck of having my first day of work as an attorney be the day that the O.J. Simpson verdict came out. So, and I was working in a way majority white law firm, and so it was an interesting lunch conversation because I was the only person of color who started work that day as we all went out to lunch together. So just and me saying a couple of things about racial disparity, let's just say that may have impacted some of my relationships with my coworkers. So I thought about that this morning because I'm thinking about all the people at work today, people of color, in particular maybe black people, where man, the NFL's decision yesterday is going to be a powder keg of a conversation in certain places. So, Edgar, I mean, how do you handle conversations that are close to your heart but that you know are going to be difficult at work?
It's always awkward. You have to understand as a professional that there are consequences to the things that you say and how you engage. So depending on the person and what they're saying, sometimes you decide not to comment and sometimes you decide to educate in a very polite way. Or I've had friends who take the opposite approach and just like go at it and say, hey, you're not gonna stop me from speaking my truth. And so everybody has a very different way of approaching it. I think that ultimately it becomes a decision of, if I say something, what are the consequences? And am I willing to accept those consequences, whatever they may be?
Great. I'm going to take a call right now. Michael, you there?
Yes.
Great. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I do have a question. Here in the Midwest, when we speak about people with color, I think we're usually talking about African Americans and Latinos. And I was just reminded on a recent trip out to the West Coast just how many Asian Americans there are in the United States. I think it's a very fast growing population. And kind of the third group in the room, if you would, for that term, people of color.
Right, you're absolutely right.
Of course, it's a very, you know, Asia's a big place. Indians, Filipinos, Chinese, very different cultures, thousands of years old, kind of here in the American context, get lumped into the same category as Asian Americans. Yet, nonetheless, as a group, they seem to be doing very well. I think they're more highly educated than our whites, and their average income is greater than whites. So, and of course, we recognize that they still encounter prejudice. There was that terrible shooting last year in the bar, but overall, it's seemingly doing quite well. Just wondered what your guests would comment about their experience and how that fits into this broader discussion.
Real quick, thank you for that question, Michael. Before I toss this to my guest, I just want to say you're absolutely right that the term people of color not only includes blacks, Latinx, and Asians, it also includes Native Americans. I also wanted to say that as someone who has friends who are of Asian descent, that they deal with a lot of the exact, what we're talking about isn't about how much money you make. It's about whether you can be your authentic self when you go to work. It's about whether you can behave in a way, even something as little as picking up the phone to talk to your mother in a language that your coworkers don't recognize. That can be just as stressful to someone, regardless of what they're making, no matter what their position is. So anyway, what do you two have to say about that?
No, I thank you, Michael, for the question or the comment. In studying some diversity and inclusion information, I've heard Asian cultures described as the model minority because of some of the aspects that you have mentioned. And as people of color, we have some shared obstacles to overcome and some shared navigation. And then there's also things that historically, as being marginalized groups and groups from oppressed circumstances, that make access to opportunities look different. So it's nuanced at best, but instead of doing silos of Latinx, African American, Asians, Native Americans, while we have our unique cultural identities, we have some shared experiences in terms of trying to navigate the system.
Edgar, anything before we go on?
I'll say this. So I cannot speak, and this is something that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago to one of my friends. Latinos, African Americans, we're not a monolith, right? So I can't comment. I can only comment on my experiences and not the experiences of those. And so therefore, I don't feel comfortable commenting on the experience of the Asian American in the society. But I will say, I agree with Nicole, that when you're not in the majority, there are very distinct elements that we all share, that we have all seen, and that we've all experienced together. And our stories, when we get together and we talk about these issues, there are a lot of commonalities. There's a lot of common threads around these environments. So I can't comment on what that's like. However, I will say that there are a lot of successful people of color as well, whether they're African American or Latino, Native American, Asian American. So it's not just about one specific group. It's about realizing that as groups who are not in the majority, we are very successful in our own rights, and we have things that we want to share that are a part of this American fabric.
Thanks, Drew. I'm going to take a call from Connie. I think she has similar comments. Hey, Connie, this is Michelle. Did you want to join in our conversation for a minute?
Yes. Hi, this is Connie.
Hi.
I do have one question about the difference between race and cultural diversity. In workspaces, I have noticed that, I know you have talked about colorism and the privilege of light-skinned Latinas. Acknowledging that there is a difference between in the Latinx community, there's Afro-Latinas, white passing, white Latinos, in jobs, often taking in those that are white passing Latinos or white Latinos as diversity. So that does include cultural diversity. It's not necessarily racial diversity.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Edgar, did you want to
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, I think that statement highlights what a topic that is very uncomfortable within our own communities, which is, again, colorism. You know, it is hard for us to say that sometimes we can be prejudicial against our own. But that is possible. And it does happen. I think one way of solving that issue is those that have those privileges, again, have to make room at the table for those that don't. And you have to make those environments comfortable. And so it is an active choice. It's an active decision to do that, because we can't forget about our own brothers and sisters out there trying to make it work for themselves every day.
Great.
And just continuing on what Edgar said, when we're talking about colorism, to know that this is systemic. It's not something that we can change very quickly unless we get to the heart and root of what is happening. And it also, of course, colorism in the African-American community is prevalent as well. And addressing that within our own community and getting at the heart of how we even speak about it in our families is crucial in continuing the conversation.
It is so true. And again, it goes back generations. I mean, oh, man. So we have another call from Chris. Chris, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Michelle.
Yes, ma'am. You know, I work at the airport driving a shuttle bus, and I talk to the customers every day. And I noticed that 99% of the customers who are traveling for business meetings are always white, and less than 1% are black. Doesn't make any sense. That just shows you the problem in diversity as far as higher up in the higher end of the work of corporations. Like I said, 99%. Out of 500 people that I may talk to who are traveling for business meetings, maybe one out of every 500 is a black person.
That really is a great way of sort of gauging that. I never would have thought about that, but that makes perfect sense. Were you going to say something, Nicole?
I was. I what as our caller did, I think as a person of color, I know I do this, and I speak about this with friends. I kind of scan environments to see the diversity, and often it's on, if I'm just scanning, I'm looking at race, and it can be if I'm looking at the top whatever listing that the Business Journal may have done, I look to see how many people of color are represented. It may be a room that I'm in, it may be a website that I'm looking at, an organization, but looking to see where there's representation is something that I think many of us do to kind of gauge how is this environment supporting people of color. So that's a very interesting comment. I've never specifically noticed that when traveling, but I'm going to look the next time for sure.
I know. I guess I have noticed that when I am picked up for a business trip, that especially if it's a person of color who's driving, they seem so happy. Like, oh, hey, you're here for business? So, yeah. Yeah. Edgar, you're going to say something?
Well, you know, the other thing I think that that I struggle with right now is trying to find the difference between a microaggression and just a normal interaction. And so I try not to make everything about race or ethnicity or anything, you know, but it's becoming really difficult. This is a comment that I've made recently. It's just, it is becoming really difficult for me to understand if something is said because I may be different, or...
Could you explain to the people listening who may not know what a microaggression is, what a microaggression is?
That's what I'm struggling to figure out. But, you know, a microaggression, I would explain it as a comment, a snide comment that may happen that that may be just said randomly or just throwing it out there. Like, oh, Nicole, you do so great for who you are. Or, you know, something something like that. And
it's like the word when people say, I'm sure you've heard it, Nicole, to a black person, oh, you're so articulate.
Articulate, exactly.
Well, I mean, considering the job I hold, I would hope that
I went to school. I got 3 degrees. Yeah. I understand why I'm articulate, that kind of stuff. But, it's been really difficult to be in environments, especially in different areas of the country, to understand like how people interact with you and to try to determine and giving people the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they didn't mean it that way. That's been one of those issues that I've been struggling with. And I don't know, if Nicole, if you've faced similar.
I love this topic because I think I was raised, and I'm just speaking from my household, to give people the benefit of the doubt. Think of everything else. And then if you come with nothing else, then it's maybe racially motivated. So that's my touchstone. But I think as people of color, if you feel it in your gut, you know. And when you said microaggressions, they stay with you. Like I can remember, it's over 10 years ago, someone said, oh, your name's Nicole. Aren't you so glad that your parents named you something normal? And I knew she was intending to compliment, but it felt anything but. And so the term microaggression is so interesting because microaggressions often feel like macroaggressions.
Right. Yeah. It's that thing that on the surface seems innocent. And so sometimes that's why we maybe don't address it on the spot. Because they can go, but it was innocent. I didn't mean anything by it. And they may not have. That's where unconscious bias comes in. So, first of all, we're about to switch gears. I want to say a big and thank you and goodbye to Nicole Jacob-Sylvie, president and founder of Connection Coach KC, and Edgar Palacios. He's the founder of Latinx Education Collaborative. We could have this conversation all day long, right?
Yes, yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you. When we return, we'll speak with the new member of Saturday Night Live's team and a Kansas City native, Heidi Gardner. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson in for Gina Kaufman. Stay with us.
Let's talk about something happy.
Yes.
The Snoopy balloon is returning this Thanksgiving for the parade.
Come on, Snoopy is 60 years old, all right? I can't take it. You can't take it. You know how many men it takes to hold you up? You're done. You're a broken down piece of rubber, all right?
That was a skit from Saturday Night Live called I don't know if that's the right skit, but every boxer's girlfriend from every movie about boxing ever. And Heidi, are you there?
I'm here.
Can I tell you how excited I am to talk with somebody from Saturday Night Live? I have been watching it for an embarrassing number of years. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're fellow all school girls, grads from St. Teresa's. I'm from St. Teresa's. You went to Sion, right?
So yep, yeah.
When you were at Sion, did you ever think that you would end up being on Saturday Night Live?
No. I mean, you know, I used to do fun sketches and like our talent shows or things like that, but that's about as far as I thought I'd get with that.
So I hear that you went out to LA to be a hairdresser.
Yep.
How did that happen? I got to hear about that career path.
Yeah, I had decided that I wanted to pursue hair and makeup, but you know, I was dropping out of school and a little insecure about that. So I was like, well, you know, if I do it in LA, I think that sounds more legit. So, you know, I just did that dumbly as a young 21-year-old and moved to LA, and I worked in a salon for 9 years. I had a clientele, and that was what I thought my career path was going to be probably forever. And then things changed.
So, you know, you worked there for 9 years as a hairdresser, which is a really long time. You know,
mm-hmm.
You haven't spun the story about how your second day of work you were doing hair and then a casting agent came in and then saved you from a life of, you know, giving people haircuts. I mean, I say that because there's always that story that happens with people discovered. Yeah. So how did you get to sketch comedy?
Well, you know, I mean, I, like you, I always loved Saturday Night Live. I always loved comedy, was obsessed with movies growing up. And so it was always in the back of my mind, just as something I loved. But, you know, if I just didn't think, like, if you weren't an actor when you were a kid or hadn't been doing it forever, you know, you don't get to do that then. But in L.A., it was pretty cool because there's a theater called the Groundlings Theater. And I met a friend who was in the Groundlings at the time, and she said, come see me in a show tonight. And I went to, this was about 6 years ago, I went to an improv show there and was just blown away. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And then that weekend I went and saw a sketch show there, and it was also the funniest thing I'd ever seen. But I didn't really know what to do with that information. And she was like, you should take a class here at the Groundlings, you know, there's classes. And I was like, well, I'm not an actor. And she was like, just do it. And so I just started taking classes and falling in love with it and not having any direction, just knowing, like, I think this is really helping my life get better and it's making me happier. And I didn't have a plan. I just knew I'd fallen in love with something.
Isn't that the way, though? Don't you think? Don't you think that
sometimes
it's like when people who work so hard to make something happen and they can't seem to catch a break, but love of something just seems to attract all sorts of great things?
Yeah, it was very unexpected, but made so much sense at the same time. And it was neat those first few years at Groundlings, just taking the classes and not knowing that there were certain levels or that you could achieve, you could get to a certain place. It was just like, well, this is just for the love of the game, I guess. So that was neat.
So you said you had not done acting before that. In some ways, wasn't that an advantage because you didn't have, you know, a way of doing things before an audience that you had to get rid of or you had to adjust?
I think so, probably. I mean, I mostly would say it was more of a hindrance just because there are so many people around me that I know that are people that have been acting for so many years that once I figured out, oh, this is what I want to do, I was so jealous of the skills they've already collected.
Right.
You know, just
there
are just some things that I'm still learning, you know, that I see friends of mine do so easily. And I'm like, oh, how do they tap into that so quickly? But they didn't. They've been doing it for years.
I totally get it. I'm a playwright here in town. And when I see actors get up there on stage, I'm like, I'm glad it's you and not me having to do that.
Yeah.
Because you're right. You see them totally just tap into something. And you're right. It's oftentimes it's training and it's experience. I have a caller who wants to ask you. Well, you know, I think actually I don't think she's ready yet. So I'm going to keep talking to you because I'm fascinated. Because I'm just fascinated. As I said, I'm somebody who's watched SNL for years. And like last week, you got to be in a cold opening with like all these people who are big. I mean, you're big now too, of course. But but you know what I mean? It's like, my God, who was there on the stage? You had De Niro, and then for the monologue, there was Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld. Yeah. Like, how is that? Does that, do you sometimes just pinch yourself and go, what?
Yes, it's just insane. It doesn't make any sort of sense at all. I mean, yeah, even, you know, Ben Stiller was in that cold open.
That's
and
right.
One of my comedy idols forever. I mean, my older brother and I were obsessed with his movies. Like, I wanted to name one of my cats Stiller, and my mom wouldn't let me. I mean, it was just...
And look what happens, and then you meet him on your job on Saturday Night Live. You know, the thing that always gets me on Saturday Night Live, when the show's over, every show, and I'm this tells you how big a geek I am. I always look to see everybody standing on stage together, and everybody's, you know, hugging and smiling, and it's like this happy thing of just friends who hung out together for a week. And I thought, I mean, is that what it's like when you're saying goodbye at the end of these shows?
Yeah, people are, you know, congratulating each other on, you know, a good week or a good performance, or just that we got through it, or, you know, it is really supportive, and everyone's been so friendly since I've gotten there. It does feel really like family.
Great. I do have a call. Let me get this call. MK, this is Michelle. How are you today?
I am well today, Michelle. What a great show.
Thank you. Did you have a comment or a question for Heidi?
I certainly do have a comment for Heidi. Congratulations, Heidi. I don't know you, but I've seen every SNL since way before you were born, girl. And I'm thrilled that you made this show. So I have what I think is a great compliment for you. Remembering this sketch, crazy sketch, where Bill Hader was in a wheelchair, and it just, oh, it was a sex thing, and it just got crazier and crazier. And the cast broke up, and I come from theater, so I don't buy the cast breaking up. I don't think that's funny. To me, it's funny when they hold and they don't break up. And I saw one person in that perhaps six-person group not break a lick, and it was you. And I'd already been really excited that a hometown girl made the cast, but you made your chops for me that day because the rest of them broke and you didn't give an inch. So I'm so happy for you, so happy for you.
That's a great
point. Thank you so much.
a great point, MK, because, again, I've been watching it probably since before you were born too, Heidi. And I see them. And there are some skits, and I will not mention a certain former cast person who has his own TV show now, but where I'm like, can you just please get through a skit without breaking character? Just please, just one, just one, you know? Mm-hmm. And I do think, I mean, that's really impressive that you do that. You have so much. Okay, so I have to also ask this question, because, again, I'm glad that I don't have to memorize lines, and you have a lot of lines that you have to memorize quickly, don't you? Because don't those sketches, like, change rapidly?
They do change, but there's cue cards there as well. Oh. So, you know, it's a little of both, though. You know, coming from the Groundlings, you know, we memorized our sketches, so I'm used to memorizing, and I like to know, you know, I like to have it in there. I like to know what I'm going to say. So it's amazing to have the cue cards there as well, just in case, because you're on live TV and you don't want to forget. So it's a little of both for me. I like to know my dialogue, and then the cue cards are always there to help, and they're, you know, they're placed where it looks, you know, where you should be looking, like who you'd be talking to. So
Well, it's place
they
for
take care of you.
It's place for some people where you are not able to tell, and then you have, and it's usually a guest host where it's like, okay, I know exactly where the cue card holder person is, and right. So that's the other thing I admire about you guys is that, I mean, I think the sign of a professional is someone who makes it look easy even when it's hard. And you and the rest of the cast really make it look easy. Do you have any like fun stories that you can like tell us about just some encounter you had with the star or something? We won't tell anybody, we promise. Nobody will know. We won't tell them.
A fun encounter. Oh geez. I mean, it's just been a very, very fun year there. Oh boy.
Yeah, that's right. Because this is all brand new for you.
Yeah, all brand new. You know, the week that Will Ferrell was there was really amazing because, you know, with him being an alum of the show, you know, everyone was just in such a good mood. Like the crew that had been there when he was there was so excited, and the cast was so excited. I mean, that week was the most like selfless writing week I'd ever seen because you just wanted to write things for him to do, like just to see what him read stuff at the table read because he's so hilarious. Mm. And so it was a fun week all around. And then I got to do Weekend Update that weekend, and he was also doing Weekend Update, and he was on Colin's side and I was on Michael's side. So as Weekend Update's going, we're across from each other, across from the desks, waiting in the wings, each to do our parts. And I looked over and he was waving at me, giving me the thumbs up, you know, and mouthing, "You can do it."
Aww.
And it was like, you know, I couldn't believe that was happening.
Right, right. But you know, especially in light of, you know, all the bad news about, you know, men behaving badly, right? It's always good to hear the good stories about the men that you hear about, that you like, that you admire. Like I like Will Ferrell too, and you hear like, okay, that's great that he's just as good a guy as he appears to be. So that is pretty awesome. Yeah, I remember this because you were playing every boxer's girlfriend from every movie. That was did you help write that skit?
Yeah, when I
is the word skit or sketch? What's the proper words? I don't want to be insulting because I know that there's a difference.
I would say that it's sketch.
Sketch. I'm so sorry. Yeah. I apologize. Okay.
No, it's fine. But yes, I wrote the first time I did Every Boxer's Girlfriend, I wrote that one on my own. And then the second time, one of the writers, Sudie Green, and I wrote the second version that I did.
Great. So do you get to do a lot of writing for SNL?
Yeah. Yeah. Every week.
Oh, really?
I'm writing.
Wow, that's great. Okay, I got to ask this question. I would kick myself forever if I didn't. Were you at any point in the room when they were working on that Black Panther Jeopardy sketch which is like one of the funniest sketches like ever?
Right? I mean so one of the writers on that sketch, Sam Jay, she and I share an office together. Mm. So that night, that writing night, you know, she was back and forth with Michael Che, who was also a writer on it. You know, they were pitching jokes. He was in and out of the office. So I was just kind of hearing tidbits of what was going on. And then the next day when they read it at the table read, you know, it absolutely crushed. And So it was so cool to kind of see like how it was even getting pieced together.
Oh yeah.
So good.
I you know, as a writer, I love process. So I would have totally loved that. So that's great that you get to write also. So what you have something else that's coming up, Life of the Party, right?
Yep, Life of the Party, which just came out May 11th, so it's in theaters now.
Okay.
And that stars Melissa McCarthy. And then I do a voice on the TV show Super Mansion, which is on Sony Crackle's network.
Okay. And so you do all that based out of New York, right? New York City, right?
No. Well, Super Mansion I did in L.A. and Life of the Party in Atlanta. So Okay. Kind of all over the place.
So I guess that's pretty different for you, right? I mean, you're that girl. You get to go around the country, maybe even around the world, just being a star in your own right. I mean, I know professionals don't like to think of themselves as stars, but okay, just bear with me. The rest of us think you are a star. So
okay, but but I've been traveling more than I have ever. So yeah, getting used to that.
So is there anything you're particularly excited about? Because the season for SNL is over. I think this last one was the first one. So what are you going to do this summer?
I would like to go back to LA and do a show at the Groundlings. I'm still a member of the main company there, so I want to go do a sketch show there for maybe a couple months. I would like to, so hopefully that works out, and hang out with my cats. And I'm going to the Indy 500 this weekend. So that's what I'm doing.
That will be fun, fun, fun. Well, and I would imagine during the season, except for maybe like winter breaks or whatever, you don't get to travel as much because you've got to be, you know, boots on the ground for the show that week, right?
Yes. But, you know, a lot, I'm learning from other cast members that when those, you know, 2 or 3 week breaks come up, they take some good vacations. Like they really use their time well, I should say, on the break. So that's good to know that
makes sense, that right?
You just got to
plan for it, right? So of course I got to ask the obvious in our last, you know, few minutes together. When are you coming back home to Kansas City?
I would like to come at some point this summer. I don't have a trip planned, but I usually go around the holidays and then sometime in the summer. So
that's good. That's good. I mean, what are your favorite things to do when you're in Kansas City? I mean, I know you grew up here, so it's probably not that different than anybody else who lives here. But we all want to know what you do what do you like to do when you come home?
I like to get barbecue with my dad.
Okay, I was going to ask you that. What's your barbecue of choice?
Ooh, it's hard. So Arthur Bryant's I love just across the board. But then I love how Gates is just so signature. Like I can taste Gates right now.
Yep.
I know exactly
yep.
what it
yep. I know exactly what it means. Like. When I lived away from home, I would like come home and the first thing I would get would be Gates barbecue sauce. And now that I've been back home for like 20 years, I'm like, oh yeah, Gates. You know?
Yeah. Because it's, you just know it.
Right.
And so, then for burnt ends, I love LC's.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
You are indeed a Kansas City person, okay? Because not any old person can, you know, break it off like that and mention all the iconic. And let me just tell you, I'm not going to mention any names on the air, but, you know, if you come back, you know, look a sister up and I'll hook you up with a couple of new places. There's some other really good places, you know, because this is Kansas City and one has to know all the different places to go.
Yeah.
So I know you have how much of your family's here? I know your brother's here because I don't know him, but we're Facebook friends. Cause in the world of theater and actors, you know, we kind of sort of have this loose knowledge of one another. So
So my older brother's there, my dad's in Kansas City, and my mamaw and bampo, those are my grandparents.
Aww.
And then I still have so many friends in Kansas City, so yeah, it's always great to come back.
That is really great. Anything else about, you said you're going back to LA for the Groundlings and then maybe home for a quick trip. And then the season starts in what, September? The next SNL?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It always.
Right.
It's usually somewhere in there, September, October-ish. I think.
So are you going to give us, are you going to give me a hint on who's going to open next season? You know, I'm in the news, I like to be in the know.
I can't give you anything. I know nothing.
Man, what good are you hiding? You can't help your KC peeps out, let them, you know something a little more than the rest of the world? No.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
Nope.
I understand. I totally understand about trying to keep a job. I get it. I get it. I get it. Well, this has been really awesome talking to you. We really appreciate you being with us today. Hopefully we will bump into you in Kansas City sometimes. Maybe, like I said, you know, look me up. I'll tell you a new place. And best of luck with everything over at SNL. You can tug on your earlobe like Carol Burnett, you know, to say hello to me sometime. Our time is up for today's show, but you can listen back to any of our episodes at KCUR.org/Central Standard. This one will be here by the end of the day, KCUR.org. If you missed yesterday's discussion about the issue of school choice in Kansas City, be sure and check it out online. Tomorrow, the food critics are back to talk about the best places to find fried chicken around Kansas City. Today, Central Standard was produced by Coy Duggar. Our senior producer is Sylvia Marie Gross. I got to say a shout out to Anna back there. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Up to Date is next here on KCUR. Stay with us.